It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new law in Wisconsin will require high school students to take a course that includes lessons on money management, on investing, credit, debt. We examine the mandate and hear your thoughts on it. Call in with a question, add comments. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Janelle Espinal is Director of Educational Outreach for the nonprofit Next Gen Personal Finance. Janelle, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm excited that this time around we're talking about successful legislation.
Yes. How will learning about financial literacy in a high school classroom help these young people manage their money decades later in life?
Yeah, you know, this is one of the things that I would point to the research on, because so many people wonder, you know, well, what impact can it really have? And the research actually shows that when you provide financial literacy education just in time, which is shown to be the upper grade levels of high school in particular, so junior and senior year, that this is when students are making really important choices like comparing car insurance rates and, you know, deciding whether they want to get a credit card, if they want to be an authorized user on their parents' or uncle's or aunt's credit cards, and how to start using that to establish credit. They're deciding whether they want to go on to college, and if so, how they're going to pay for college, which means potentially student loans. They're deciding so many important financial choices about their lives, whether they want to set up direct deposit, if they're getting a paycheck from work, or if they rather just cash paper checks the old school way or use a payroll card, which can be costly. And so this class is coming at this opportune moment in time when teenagers are making important financial choices every day. And so they'll be able to apply these lessons almost immediately to their real financial lives.
It seems like teachers then could really attach to this, because you could use more relatable examples for teens, you know, instead of something that might be really far off, like a mortgage. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, choosing a credit card or financing a first car or how to pay for college, I mean, these are much more urgent and sooner in their trajectory.
Absolutely. And that's the reality of life being a teenager in America. Like, a lot of people will say, oh, this is so important for their future, for their financial future, but it's actually very important for their financial present. Students are oftentimes, they have bank accounts. They're often already banking, right? Or they have a checking account or savings account at a credit union. And so it's very important for students to be able to understand how to compare and contrast different types of bank accounts and how to look for competitive interest rates when they're saving. Maybe they're saving for graduation. Maybe they're saving for their first car. Maybe they're saving for prom tickets. We don't know what their goals are, but we know that teenagers use money daily, if not weekly and monthly, to purchase food, to go shopping, to, you know, get entertainment, games, to save for their goals. And so for us to pretend that this class is only preparing them for a financial future 10, 20 years down the line, you know, it's really doing them a disservice by not acknowledging all of the financial choices that they make on a day-to-day basis.
Janelle, your organization, Next Gen Personal Finance, has some numbers for us. Nearly 24% of students nationally attend a school where one semester of personal finance is required. Here in Wisconsin, nearly 35% of high school students have a financial literacy requirement. What do successful financial literacy programs have in common?
Yeah, so actually the stats are looking a little better. The figure 24 is 24 states now, which Wisconsin officially became the 24th state to have a full semester graduation requirement for personal financial literacy. So what that means is, like, before, the state of Wisconsin already had really, really strong financial literacy standards in place. It was actually a leader on this issue with very, very strong standards, teacher training through Edgewood College for a number of years, leadership from the governor, who has had a financial literacy council in place, as well as from Dave Mansell, you know, which he's been a very vocal advocate and leader over at the Department of Financial Institutions Office of Financial Literacy. So Wisconsin has had so much in place already. And in particular, those state standards are really incredibly strong. However, what it meant was that it was sort of like a suggestion that schools should be teaching this, versus now this legislation says, hey, you got to be teaching this, and it's got to happen for at least a semester being half of a year long course. So this is really what the shift is, becoming the 24th state, meaning that now when you look at the percentage of students across the country and add up all of those students in those 24 states, we're looking at some of the most populous states. We're looking at really big states now that have this requirement, right? Including states like Michigan, who is a more recent addition. Wisconsin is added to the list, but this is something that is now reaching half of the students in the country. And so that's, I think, the really important thing to know is that even though we're at 24 states, the percentage of students getting access to this class in the country is really, really high, because we've got states like, you know, really, really large states that have been doing this for a really long time, large states that have added this in the past year or two, like Michigan, Georgia, Florida, Ohio, some really big states. And so that's really the goal here, is to be able to say, let's look across the country and see how many teenagers, how many current high school students are getting access, and let's bridge that gap. So in Wisconsin, there were about 35%, 36% of students that were already guaranteed to get this class before. And now we're bridging that gap, and we're saying we're going from 35% to 100% of students in the state.
We're talking about the new state law requiring high school students to take a financial literacy class before graduation. And we have financial educator Janelle Espinal. You can join in. Questions and comments are welcome at 800-642-1234. Financial advice, it often involves better ways to save and invest. How should teachers consider talking about financial literacy when our state authorities estimate 40% of households in Wisconsin struggle to afford basic household necessities?
Yeah, I absolutely love this question. I mean, I grew up in a very low-income family, and I think that this course would have been an incredibly aspirational course for a student like me, because, you know, when you think about the fact that the financial choices that you make in a home that has access to a very low income are going to be so critical, because you're dealing with limited resources. And so it's really important at that level to be very aware and educated on how to keep banking fees low, and how to manage credit responsibly, and how to, you know exactly what the predatory practices in the financial space that are around you are, what do those look like, and how to avoid those. And I think it's still important to talk about investing, right? And so I think a class like this can really have an impact on the rest of their lives ahead of them, but also it's something they can take back home to their families, and it creates this ripple effect where they go home and say, "Mom, Dad, did you know that if you carry a really high balance on your credit card, that's one of the reasons why your credit score will be dropping really low? But the moment that you pay off a chunk of that, or if you carry a lower amount of credit card debt, your credit score will get a boost." Oftentimes, parents don't know this. The families themselves have never been taught this. That's why a law like this one is so important, because for the first time ever, we're saying every single student is going to get this when they graduate high school. Because of Assembly and Senate Bill 109, we're not going to have another generation repeating the same cycle saying, "Well, I don't know this because I didn't get a class about it. I wish I had." Mm. Now everyone's going to say, "Well, this is the class that we're so glad we got."
But I wonder, Janelle, you know, money is so personal. And I'm wondering if should financial literacy, a class like this, involve a bit of back and forth with teens instead of like, "Here's how you do this. Here's what you need to know." Should teachers get a sense of the teens' financial goals or what they've experienced in their lives with money?
100%. And I think that your point is larger than just a back and forth. What I think it is the way that the course needs to be taught. We need, as educators and teachers, we all need to avoid teaching classes as if we are evangelizing or even as if we're dissuading students from certain choices. Because our goal as an educator is not to move students to agree or disagree with any one particular thing. Instead, what we're here to do is empower them and give them the time and the space to explore different topics. We're not here to push credit cards on them. We're also not telling them to avoid credit. Instead, we're here to examine credit. What is the credit system in the United States look like? How can you participate if you choose to? What would happen if you choose not to? What's a good credit score? What's a not so great credit score? How do you attain a good score? How do you not, you know, get a good score? What are the things that would help you, you know, to boost your score? again, this is a very exploratory. And so students are walking away with a lot of knowledge, with a lot of content that they can then choose to apply. But I think that as educators, we need to stay away from saying, this is what you need to do or what you should do. And instead, we need to ask students open-ended questions and provide them with activities that are hands-on where they have to do the research and they have to go and see, hey, how does this apply to me and my family situation? Because that's going to look very different student by student and household by household.
Stepping back here for a moment, this new mandate here in Wisconsin will start with the 2028 graduating class. Why does the on-ramp, the implementation, require several years?
Yeah, well, I'll note the graduating class of 2028 is actually next year's incoming freshmen. So it's really important to note that's actually coming right around the corner, right? It's the students that are coming into high school next year who will graduate in 2028. So we're getting these students in high school next year. By the time they graduate, they have to take the class. But I will tell you that gives us a few years, which I think is very important to have that timeline because schools have to adjust, right? Some schools have already been doing this in the state of Wisconsin, but the schools that have not yet done this before, they need to learn from some of the schools that have done this well. And that means cross district conversations to say, hey, how did you adjust your master schedule? How did you make sure the teachers felt qualified and competent and that they were trained well to teach this course with confidence? And it starts often by training one teacher and then offering one section and then growing it from there. But that, you know, that takes time.
Janelle, thank you for joining us.
Of course. I'm so excited to talk about this, if you can't tell.
I can tell. Janelle Espinal, Director of Educational Outreach for the nonprofit Next Gen Personal Finance and a financial educator on YouTube at MissBeHelpful.com. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The publication Coffee Review has a pulse on the specialty coffee industry, and the editors rank this year's most exciting coffees from thousands of cups sampled across the world. A Madison roaster comes out on top, which caught our attention. Call in with the question. Share your comments on coffee. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 for conversation. Email ideas at WPR.org. Laura Salinger Johnson is co-owner of JBC Coffee Roasters. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And Michael Johnson here as well, founder of JBC Coffee Roasters. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Yes. So, Michael, starting with you, Connoisseur Magazine Coffee Review ranked your Wilton Benitez Pink Bourbon Columbia Roast as this year's top coffee in the world. Can you describe it to us? What is its flavor profile?
Well, it's a super bright coffee. It's very has a lot of fruit notes. It's very creamy and silky on the body. It's one of the most delicious coffees I've ever tasted in my life.
Why is that? Because you taste a lot of coffees, I would imagine.
We do taste a lot of coffees here at JBC. You know, we're looking for coffees that really shine and stand out in terms of having real clarity in the cup, lots of bright fruit notes, a crisp, clean, sweet acidity, and a nice silky body.
So what about the balance with acidity? What do you look for there when you try to make sure that you have kind of some of that evenness, that balance in the coffee?
Yeah, usually when we're talking about balance, we're talking about the interplay between the acidity and the body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if it's got good balance, you'll find the sensation where the acidity comes in and cleans your mouth up and the body tries to follow in quickly behind it, but there's almost a fight between the body and the acidity in your mouth. And in the end, it ends up nice and creamy and smooth. And those are the cups we usually denote as balanced.
So, Laura, the Pink Bourbon variety is gathering interest. It's considered the a new darling of specialty coffee. That's by the coffee news publication Perfect Daily Grind. What is the draw to the Pink Bourbon?
The Pink Bourbon is a really sweet cup. So they found that this coffee actually has a higher sucrose number. So it has more sweetness. It's new. It was discovered in Colombia, and it's just a really lovely, like Michael said, a really lovely balanced cup with a lot of natural sweetness.
And then in the name of your roast, who is Wilton Benitez?
So he's a grower in Colombia. He's an engineer turned coffee grower. So he's doing a lot of really unique things at the farm level in terms of innovation and coffee processing. The specific coffee is an anaerobic fermentation coffee, and he's really experimenting with a lot of different ways to process coffee on the farm level and create these really unique cup values.
And he's also using, I think I read about a process of thermo shocking the coffee. What does that do?
Yeah, so he first hits the coffee with really, really hot water to kind of open it up and allow all the flavors from the fermentation to kind of take hold. And then he'll hit it with a really cold flavor with cold water to kind of tighten those beans up.
So do you have to take a different approach then in terms of roasting when that coffee has been kind of shocked in the processing of it?
Well, I might answer that. All the coffees here get a unique roast profile. And so after we've sampled the coffee on our small sample roaster, before it goes, you know, before we release it, we do test batches on our large production roaster and, you know, sample those batches to determine, you know, various different curves and which are going to show that coffee the best.
So, Michael, you're a certified Q grader for evaluating coffee. What are you seeking out? What are you searching for when grading a coffee?
Well, really, sweetness is one of the main goals. And so we're looking for balanced cups that have high levels of sweetness and familiar flavor profiles for people. And so people like a certain range of flavors, and we try to give them that.
Laura, how can someone, you know, develop a more refined taste for coffee? If they say, nah, coffee, not for me, how does one develop a taste?
I think it's similar to like wine and beer. You just start tasting coffees, and if you start tasting coffees against each other, you start to realize really what's a really good sweet cup. We do cuppings at our location where we teach people kind of how to taste coffee. We don't tell them, you know, that you have to be super specific. You don't have to give me this flavor note or that. Just let me know if you think the cup is good, if it's sweet, if it's balanced, and really just go from there.
You both say that one of your favorite parts of the job is the relationships that are developed with the farmers who grow the beans. Michael, what is that like? And do the beans or the roast make more of a difference in quality when you have those deep-seated relationships?
Oh, yeah. I can't tell you the value in the relationships. It's been humbling for us and having the ability to travel around the world and meet all these different people and see their lifestyle and how they make things work. And it's a real humbling process. And you realize the effort and the passion these people have that produce some of these best coffees. It's not by chance that the greatest coffees are coming out of some of these very unique, distinct places. It's through a lot of concerted effort, and it's meant a lot to us. It's really humbling, again, just to see the amount of effort and work that goes into producing such a 1 pound of coffee.
When you see that amount of effort, is the Pink Bourbon variety challenging to grow for farmers?
I don't know if it's necessarily challenging. It's, it's a matter of intention. Hmm. And so, if different farmers experiment with different varietals, and some like some microclimates better than others. And so where the Pink Bourbon may grow great on Wilton Benitez's farm, it may not grow so great at somebody else's farm. And so it's really a matter of finding your little microclimates on the producing property you have and determining which varietals are going to produce best there and then processing properly.
Michael Johnson and Laura Salinger Johnson, owners of JBC Coffee Roasters. As we look at the business and tasting of coffee, you can join in questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Laura, a U.S. Geological Survey map shows southern Wisconsin has among the hardest water in the country. How does water hardness affect a cup of coffee?
We really, unfortunately, here in Madison have some of the worst water for brewing coffee. So it's not going to taste good if you use the water here. What we recommend for people is to use, we have a product called Third Wave Water, and it's a mineral add back that you can add to distilled water to brew your coffee. It's really easy.
Distilled or reverse osmosis.
Right. Really easy to use, and it will make your coffee taste a lot better. If you can't do that, I just recommend using spring water. It's kind of our theory that maybe craft coffee exploded on the East and West Coast because they have better water for brewing coffee. Water is 98% of your coffee beverage, so it's really important that you have good water to brew your coffee.
Wow, that is so essential that, it can really then affect the outcome of what you taste. Is that right, Laura?
Exactly. Yeah. It's if you're using the proper water and you're getting these really high end specialty coffees, the bright fruit notes will pop. All those flavors that we're really after will really pop. If you use kind of the tap water here in Madison, that will become a little more muddled. I like to say a good coffee is better than a bad coffee, but if using the proper water is going to really accentuate what the flavors that we're after.
I want to make this an equal opportunity type conversation here. Michael, the health information site Healthline recommends decaf over regular coffee only for people who may be caffeine sensitive. What are your thoughts on decaf coffee and developments on that front?
There have been efforts to produce higher quality decafs, but really the majority of the highest grade lots are going just straight coffee. That's a pretty rigorous process to decaffeinate coffee. They have been some efforts to genetically modify coffees that don't have decaf, but that has its own challenges and consumer concerns as well. And so I would say that the highest quality lots are really still going to just the regular market just because it's so dominated.
Hmm. Michael, you've been in the coffee business in Wisconsin for decades now. What could improve the business climate here in Wisconsin?
That's an interesting question. I mean, we've been seeing more and more cafes do multi-roaster approach where they don't get stuck with just one roaster in particular. And we like that model a lot. It really then keeps you on your toes as a roaster to produce the highest quality. And so one of our favorite cafes in Madison, Cafe Domestique, follows this model. And they bring coffees in from all over the country. They use our coffee too, but I'll tell you what, it really keeps us on our toes. And we're honored when we get a spot on their shelf. And And I think that model would help promote more higher grade coffee throughout the Wisconsin area.
It sounds like you're encouraging competition.
I'm not afraid of competition. We know we've got a good thing going on, and I encourage our competitors to do better. And so we really would like to see more specialty coffee all throughout the Wisconsin area. Our door's open, and so we'd like to spread the love.
Laura, as you spread the love, is there a market for such specialty coffee? Do people flock to it?
There really is. I think people more and more are seeking out higher end coffees, learning about it. Kind of like the craft beer market exploded. That's really happening with coffee, especially here in the Midwest. It was really took root first on the East and West Coast, and that's where a lot of our business was coming from, honestly, for a while, but we're seeing this big explosion in the Midwest, in the Wisconsin area, of people really seeking out specialty coffees, learning about these special coffees.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
It was great to be here.
Michael Johnson, founder of JBC Coffee Roasters, Laura Salinger Johnson, co-owner. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.